idle industrial units in industrial parts and zones. This is part of the Industry Clinics project. The objective is to assist idle businesses by addressing their needs and weaknesses to revive their activity.
Iran has unveiled its new line of dishwashing machines after years of research and development to manufacture these items.
So far, only one company in the country has achieved the know-how to make these machines that used to be mainly imported. These dishwashing machines were introduced to the market last year and have since grown in popularity. The company says it is launching its third and fourth phase production lines, increasing its manufacturing area to 40 hectares. This would make the manufacturing company the largest in the West Asia region. The company is also planning on partnering up with the National Bureau of Standards after purchasing advanced testing and lab equipment.
Oh, there you have it from the Home Gadgets. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
To avoid sanctions, countries are actively reopening moribund routes and creating greater connectivity across Asia. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by James M. Dorsey Ryder. This article is published under the heading Russia sanctions are sparing the new Silk Road. Here's more. When the crisis erupted in Eastern Europe, Russia took itself off the map of Eurasian transport corridors linking China and Europe. At the same time, it breathed new life into moribund routes that would allow goods to travel across the Eurasian landmass without traversing Russia. It also opened the door to greater Russian connectivity with the West Asia, South and Southeast Asia regions. Next month's summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, in the Uzbek Ancient Silk Road trading hub of Samarkand could provide a linchpin for alternative routes. The SCO, which groups China, Russia, India, Pakistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Tajikistan, is certain to set the scene for an expansion to the West Asia region, as well as agreement on the construction of a crucial Central Asian railroad. The summit is expected to finalize Iranian SCO membership. The summit will further welcome Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Egypt, Bahrain, and the Maldives as dialogue partners and Azerbaijan and Armenia as observers. The United Arab Emirates has recently also expressed interest in an association with the group. Kyrgyz officials believe that leaders of the Central Asian nation and China have agreed to sign an accord at the summit to build a 523-kilometer China-Kyrgyzstan-Uzbekistan railway that has been on the drawing board for 25 years. The railway would link the three countries with Turkey, Iran, and Central and Eastern Europe. Lack of political will coupled with logistical and technical obstacles, particularly in mountainous Kyrgyzstan, and the high cost caused delays that now appear to be perceived as less problematic because of the fallout of the crisis in Eastern Europe. Uzbek President Shavkat Mirziyoyev predicted that the railway would open new opportunities for transport corridors linking the region with markets in the Pacific Ocean area. The move will add to the widening of existing railway routes connecting east with the west. Uzbekistan has long asserted that the railway would offer the shortest route from China to markets in the West Asia region and Europe, while China sees it as a way of evading the risk of violating U.S. and European sanctions that continued transport through Russia could invoke. The new railway would feed into the rail line connecting Uzbekistan to Turkmenistan's Turkmenbashi International Seaport on the Caspian Sea. From there, it can feed into the Caucasus, Turkey, and the Black Sea via the Azerbaijani port of Baku or Iran, India, the Persian Gulf, the East Africa, through the International North-South Transportation Corridor or INSTC that makes use of the Iranian port of Anzali and potentially Chabahar. The INSTC, a 7,200-kilometer patchwork of independently operated railroads, highways, and maritime routes, also provides a corridor northward to Kazakhstan and Russia. Earlier this year, Iran and Qatar announced regular shipping lines between the two countries as part of the INSTC. Similarly, Iran's Ports and Maritime Organization, PMO, announced the launch of shipping lines between Chabahar and Dubai's Jebel Ali port. Chinese analysts also expect that the railroad, which would start in Kashgar, will help transform the economy of Xinjiang.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The attack, which occurred just outside one of the gates of the occupied old city of Al-Quds on early Sunday, left at least 9 Israeli settlers injured, 2 of whom are in serious condition. Reports indicate that at least one person ambushed a bus as it arrived at the western wall in the old city. Witnesses say that as people were boarding the bus, they heard gunshots, screams, and warnings that this was an attack. The bus driver has told Israeli media that he tried to pull away, but was unable to do so. Since then, Israeli troops have been raiding homes in a Palestinian neighborhood, and reports have emerged that several suspects were involved and that some were even arrested. Palestinian resistance groups have described the attack as a natural response to the occupying Israeli regime's daily crimes against the Palestinians, calling it a heroic act. The world, however, has remained silent when atrocities against Palestinians occur, which is on a daily basis. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights reports daily killings, detainments, and other Palestinian violations, which is described as a slow death and genocide against Palestinians. But those killings don't even get reported. This attack took place in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli troops have been stationed in large numbers. But doesn't the fact that it took place there mean that Israel is failing to prevent these attacks from occurring?
Well, the first thing to understand in the conflicts that we see developing is that the Israelis, of course, are the responsible party for a lot of the antagonism and the aggression and the attacks that are constantly erupting in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian territories, because they are constantly waging a program of genocide and attempting to remove all ethnic natural inhabitants of the lands and replace them with Israeli settlers. So what the Palestinians and other people do in these areas that are being subjected to forced extermination and relocation is the same thing that any free people would do. If anyone, including myself, was forced to leave my home or evicted or lost loved ones and experienced such a horrific program of expulsion that the Israelis daily practice, of course people would be responding with any kind of militant response that they possibly could.
Last week, Israel carried out its latest round of aggression against the Palestinian people under the pretext that it was thwarting a terror attack by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Despite the Israeli atrocity, Palestinians did strike a ceasefire deal with the regime. But the truce is widely believed to be fragile in some sense, as the Palestinians did stop their retaliatory attacks, but Israel has yet to heed their demands. All this, along with the long list of previous Israeli attacks and atrocities against Palestinians, has led to an atmosphere of tension and frustration in the occupied Al-Quds. While the US and Europe condemn the attack, they're encouraging Ukrainians to resist the Russian war, even calling for armed resistance against Russian forces. This shows the double standard approach they have towards Palestinians. But the latest Israeli attack is only one in a long list of the regime's atrocities against the Palestinians on a daily basis. From the destruction of their homes to false imprisonment and the murder of innocent people, including women and children. All this has led to widespread anger among Palestinians whose rights have been violated, leading them to take action themselves. But the question remains, will attacks similar to the bus incident increase since the Israeli violations against Palestinians will continue?
Well, the only way that the crimes against the Palestinians that the Israelis are perpetuating will end, will stop, is when the Israeli government, the Israeli people, rise up and tell their government, we cannot survive the counterattacks any longer. We cannot endure the pain and the suffering that is being inflicted upon us. So we are demanding that the government be overthrown, replaced with new leadership that will honestly and authentically seek out peaceful negotiations of peaceful coexistence that take into account a lot of the crimes and violations of treaties that have occurred in the past, but that are dedicated to moving forward in a positive, mutually agreeable way. So the Israelis and the Israeli people really are the ones that have to suffer and before they recognize that their own government, their own military are perpetuating the suffering of the Israeli people, because the Palestinians are never going to relent. They're never going to stop fighting for their lives, fighting for their children, and fighting for their homes.
How many wars is the United States fighting right now? Well, the answer is zero, as under the Constitution, Congress must declare war, and the last countries that Congress declared war on were Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary in 1942. 8 decades and what seems to be zero wars, any countries with such a record must be one of the most peaceful places on earth. But as history has shown, this is not the case with the US, as it is fighting and has waged wars on many countries across the world. It just doesn't want to call them wars. Over the last 20 years, the US has dropped an average of 46 bombs and missiles on other countries each day. And now, a new study has revealed that more than a quarter of the 400 wars which the US has sugarcoated in terms such as a military-led operation, police actions, or humanitarian interventions have taken place in West Asia and Africa. So it seems that as Americans struggle to address urgent needs at home, their governments have committed them to endless wars in an attempt to support what seems to be one of the key pillars of the US, the military-industrial complex. The
US has tried to be on the first hand, with an image of also being seen as a global policeman, which came and, of course, as some have argued, it's done more harm than good. When you look into the global dominance and production of all these weapons and also use of it in terms of interventions, you see a situation whereby US wants to be the first, to be seen the most powerful nation in the world, to be seen as the one that can intervene and maybe make a difference, whichever difference whose interest it serves. Of course, they will have to define that. It's a bit a gray area. You cannot define it very clearly.
The world seems to have entered a new era after the Second World War, one where relations between countries has been at a much more stable and peaceful state. But while the decline of war and the relative harmony among great powers is cause for celebration, the US seems to believe otherwise in light of its grand strategy and political powers that seem to be running its system, namely the military-industrial complex. The US has constantly, since the Cold War, intervened in foreign affairs and engulfed itself in wars far from its borders, wars which in most cases seemed endless and even pointless at times. But while the US military is swamped in conflicts in other countries, it's hard to see any end in sight, especially an end where it is the victor. A month into his presidency, Donald Trump said that the US no longer wins wars as it once did. And the reason behind this might be the fact that the US isn't necessarily in wars. It is in fact in foreign interventions where its presence has more often than not worsened the situation, further aggravating an already chaotic crisis. And all this may only be to support the thriving war business in the US. Big war CEOs say the chaos in the world has led to excellent prospects for them, while arms contractors say recent violence and tensions in the Ukraine conflict works in their shareholders' favor. And this leads to the questions that do war manufacturers and US foreign policy go hand in hand in promoting wars?
you think about the terrorism happening within the Sahel region, and of course, U.S. is an intervention in power also. They have to do what they have to do, use of drones and all these things. So they are giving us another reason as well. But elsewhere, whether it's in East Africa, Somali intervention, this is also given a different reason, campaign, war against terror. So there's always a reason being given. So therefore, war never looks like it's been manufactured or it's been planned, deliberately planned or calculated to maybe maximize sales of weapons. But truth be told, that whenever there's a conflict, weapons will always be used.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
Shockwaves spread across America in response to the news that the FBI had searched the private Florida residence of Donald Trump. It prompted threats of retaliation from the former U.S. president and his allies. The surge in violent rhetoric drew concerns that it could lead to civil unrest and a social crisis. Department of Homeland Security officials have been warning for months that this type of warlike rhetoric, which came to fruition on January 6th and which continues to be fueled by reactions to ongoing investigations of Trump, is increasing the risk of more widespread political violence ahead of the midterm elections in November. This comes as recent polls have shown a rising acceptance of political violence among Americans. About 1 in 3 Americans say they believe violence against the government can at times be justified. According to another study by researchers at the University of California Davis Violence Prevention Research Program and the California Violence Research Center released last month, more than half of Americans expect that a civil war will erupt in the U.S. sometime in the next few years.
I think it is a sign that the U.S. Polarization has gotten way out of hand and could be leading to a a constitutional crisis and possible civil war or social breakdown kind of situation. We have seen this polarization growing for many years.
Meanwhile, as much as 40% of election and poll workers in the largest jurisdictions in the U.S. have so far said they won't be returning to their jobs out of their own fears. Other states are seeing drop-offs too. Nearly one in three local election workers said they felt unsafe because of their jobs. The alarming partisan divide within the U.S. political system ahead of the vital midterm elections in November had raised concerns over the possibility of internal conflict.
Tensions are still high between China and Taiwan. The flare-up comes days after the provocative visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Officials in Chinese Taipei have rejected the one-country, two-systems plan proposed by China for the self-ruled island. Taipei says that only the Taiwanese can decide the island's future. The reaction came after China published a white paper on Taiwan, which Beijing says shows the resolute determination of Beijing to peacefully resolve the unification issue. The paper lays out China's position on the self-ruled island. It says Beijing would never allow any attempt to separate Taiwan, but also would make every effort to achieve unification through peaceful means. Taiwan has accused Beijing of using House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit as, quote, an excuse to destroy the status quo. Pelosi visited the island on August 2nd, despite vehement protests from China.
What they want to do with Taiwan is fight, U.S. wants to fight China to the last Taiwanese. If not to the last Japanese, if not enough, then to the last Korean. Ultimately, the U.S. will not fight the wars. It will finance them. It will give weapons. It will antagonize us. It will antagonize both sides. And that's what they want to do. And it's actually a replica to the World War II.
Beijing reacted with an unprecedented burst of military around the island. The drills lasted for several days. Taiwan has also launched live fire drills in the wake of China's largest ever military exercises. The white paper issued by China this week was the third document of its kind over Taiwan. The previous editions were the Taiwan Question and Reunification of China, which was published in 1993, and the One China Principle and the Taiwan Question, which came out in 2000. China insists differences in the social systems in mainland and Taiwan are, quote, neither an obstacle to reunification nor a justification for secessionism. But Beijing says it will not rule out the military option to achieve such reunification.
What China wants to do with this white paper is just to find a way with Taiwan to get it back to its sense, because reunification will happen. The problem is that if it doesn't happen peacefully, it will happen by force. China doesn't want to do it by force, but it's being pushed on the corner by the U.S. because the U.S. is actually slowly declaring Taiwan independent.
Speaker Pelosi's controversial visit has undermined the One China policy, which is recognized by nearly all countries of the international community, including the United States. Under the policy, the international community recognizes Taiwan as part of China, and the U.S. is committed to recognizing and having formal ties with China rather than the island of Taiwan. But Washington, contrary to its stated policy, continues to undermine China's sovereignty and courts the secessionist government in Taipei.
So what is the one country, two system? It was applied actually the first time is in Hong Kong. And so since the handover in 1997, they applied the one country, two system. The way it was done in Hong Kong was that Hong Kong could keep its a very high degree of autonomy. And actually they did it for Hong Kong. And it was a way, a showcase that they could show to Taiwan to say, well, in case you were to reunify with the mainland, this would be the system.
China has proposed the one country, two systems model to win Taiwan back. The policy allowed the Chinese government to successfully solve the question of Hong Kong through diplomatic negotiations with the British government. Hong Kong was under colonial British rule since the 19th century. China resumed to exercise its sovereignty over the island on July 1st, 1997.
But what happened in Hong Kong was that you had the external forces. You had a massive amount of money being poured by NED, National Endowment for Democracy, and you had the usual suspect, the whole team of regime change working for the US, the MI6, and they did everything to destroy the one country two system in Hong Kong, and that ended up with the riots. And then in 2020, you had the national security law.
Under the model, offshore regions like Hong Kong remain under China's sovereignty but can retain their own economic and administrative systems. Now China insists the same model could be applied to Taiwan.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Almost all of the baby foods that parents in the United States feed their children, whether purchased at the store or prepared at home, contain detectable amounts of toxic heavy metals that can impair brain development, according to a new research published recently, which led to renewed demands for improved regulation. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stencil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, 94% of prepackaged and homemade U.S. baby foods contain toxic heavy metals, a study shows. Here's the story. Almost all of the baby foods that parents in the United States feed their children, whether purchased at the store or prepared at home, contain detectable amounts of toxic heavy metals that can impair brain development, according to a new study published recently, which led to renewed demands for improved regulation. A previous study by Health Babies Bright Futures, or HBBF, found that 95% of prepackaged baby foods tested were contaminated with toxic heavy metals, including lead, arsenic, cadmium, and mercury, sparking a congressional investigation and conversations about whether homemade baby foods are a safer alternative. In an effort to determine if homemade purees and foods purchased outside the baby food aisle have lower heavy metal levels than pre-made, store-bought baby food, the donor-funded Alliance of Scientists and Nonprofits recently tested 288 foods and examined more than 7,000 additional food tests from published studies. HBBF found no evidence to suggest that homemade baby food has lower heavy metal levels than store-bought brands. Lead author Jane Holyhan, the Alliance's research director, and Charlotte Brody, its national director, wrote in their newly released report. Heavy metal levels varied widely by food type, not by who made the food, notes the analysis from HBBF, which seeks to reduce infants' exposure to damaging neurotoxins. The Alliance's key findings include 94% of all food samples we tested contained detectable amounts of toxic heavy metals, 94% of store-bought baby food and 94% of homemade purees and family brand foods. Rice cakes and crisp rice cereal are heavily contaminated with arsenic. They contain higher levels of inorganic arsenic, the toxic form of arsenic, than any other foods tested. Both stand out as foods to avoid for children and adults alike. Lead, arsenic, and cadmium levels are high in some fresh carrots and sweet potatoes. We recommend that parents vary the source by choosing from different brands, varieties, or stores each week to avoid accidentally serving a high metal source often. The 10 most heavily contaminated foods consumed by babies in the U.S., beginning with the highest, are rice cakes, crisp rice cereal, rice-based puffs, brown rice, rice-based teething biscuits and rusks, white rice raisins, teething crackers, granola bar with raisins, and oat ring cereal. And the 10 least contaminated foods consumed by babies, beginning with the lowest, are bananas, grits, baby food brand meats, butternut, squash, lamb, apples, eggs, oranges, and watermelon. Mark Corkins, chair of the Committee on Nutrition for the American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, considers the recent study to be a logical follow-up to the one that HBBF conducted in 2019, after which many experts encouraged parents to switch to homemade options. With the publication of its new report, HBBF has come back and said, "We sent shoppers into all sorts of stores, and guess what? The food you are making it from is high in heavy metals as well," Corkins told The Hill, adding, "The source is going to be the same no matter what," he continued. "It's going to be farms and produce grown in dirt and water that's the same dirt and water that the other produce is grown in." In a statement released in response to the report, the AAP reiterated its call for swift, comprehensive federal regulation of heavy metals in foods that babies eat. In the meantime, the group added, families can reduce exposure by feeding babies a variety of foods. The House Subcommittee on Economic and Consumer Policy revealed last February that leading baby food manufacturers are knowingly selling products tainted with dangerous levels of arsenic, lead, cadmium, and mercury, heavy metals that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and the World Health Organization have declared a human health hazard, particularly for infants and toddlers who are most vulnerable to their serious, often irreversible, and sometimes deadly effects. HBBF advocates for what it calls a two-pronged kitchen and country approach. Until foods with reliably low heavy metal levels are widely available, parents can choose and prepare foods in ways that significantly reduce babies' exposures, states the report, which is accompanied by a two-page tip sheet for caregivers. The group says, "The most important step is to introduce and serve a variety of healthy foods, whether baby food brands or homemade foods. Serving the same food every day for a long time can accidentally concentrate one or more contaminants in a child's diet. A varied diet avoids this and ensures a healthy mix of nutrients too. But the burden shouldn't fall on parents to navigate the risks," the report says, adding, "FDA should establish and enforce protective limits for heavy metals in all foods consumed by babies and young children. Heavy metal contamination spans all the food aisles of the grocery store," the report points out. FDA safety standards must as well. Standards extending beyond the baby food aisle would encompass foods eaten during pregnancy as well, a crucial time for lowering toxic metal exposures. In a statement, Brody said that FDA's Closer to Zero program needs to live up to its name and set limits that will make the heavy metal contamination for U.S. food much closer to zero. To get the levels of heavy metals meaningfully closer to zero, FDA must go beyond the baby food aisle and set a strong standards for these contaminants.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alaiha. Gabriel would inform Fatima al-Zahra about the Prophet's position with God the Merciful and his high status. He would tell her about the events that were to unfold for her children in the future. He would tell her about the things that would happen to Imam Hassan and the events of Karbala, the events that would happen to the other Imams, peace be upon them, and about the life of the Imam of the time, Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajul sharif. And the commander of the faithful would write these down. This is a very important matter. According to the Holy Quran, Gabriel descended upon someone other than the Prophet only once in history. Then we sent to her our spirit, and he appeared to her a well-made man. The Holy Quran, Surah 19, verse 17.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If the Arabic word ruh, soul, refers to Gabriel, there is some disagreement about this. In the story of Mary, the exalted God has only sent Gabriel to someone other than a prophet just once. Of course, other angels have frequently descended upon people, but Gabriel only one time. But in the case of Lady Zahra, the discussion isn't about him descending one or two times on her. Gabriel would visit her frequently and show his respect to Lady Zahra, peace be upon her. The Holy Quran speaks about Lady Fatima in the chapter, The Man, Al-Insan, in the verse of purification, Tathir, and in the verse of Mubahila. These are verses that almost explicitly speak about Lady Zahra, peace be upon her. There are also verses that indirectly refer to that great personality as well. This is a very important point that the exalted God speaks about Fatima al-Zahra's actions and those of her family in the chapter Al-Insan. This is a flag that the Holy Quran raises up and places on the door of the house of Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. We only feed you for Allah's sake. We desire from you neither reward nor thanks. The Holy Quran, Surah 76, verse 9. These personalities work for God, are sincere, show purity and offer selfless services. To whom? To orphans, to the needy and to captives.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all
me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Researchers find that the U.S. had become an outlier among other rich countries in mortality rates long before the pandemic, and that Americans are dying younger than their peers abroad. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Lynn Paramore Ryder. This article is published under the heading, United States of Death? Study shows worrying mortality rates of broken health system. This is the first part of the story. When it comes to health in the United States, a fundamental prerequisite to a fulfilling life, the U.S. isn't delivering and hasn't been for a long time. Researchers now find that the big picture of health failings is even graver than we already knew. Piles of studies have called attention to the fact that in the country ranking number one in healthcare spending per capita, people are living shorter lives, feeling more depressed, and are more likely to skip treatment due to cost than in many developed nations. In a performance ranking of 11 high-income countries compiled by the Commonwealth Fund in 2021, the American healthcare system came in dead last with the worst outcomes of any of the nations studied. The only wealth is life, wrote the 19th century critic John Ruskin. Recent research indicates that America may be rich in dollars, but getting poorer in ways that matter most. In a stunning new report, Missing Americans, Early Death in the United States, between 1933 to 2021, Boston University professor of global health and epidemiology, Jacob Bohr, and colleagues pored over data from the CDC and a global mortality database. During the period investigated, they compared U.S. mortality rates with those of Canada, Japan, and 16 Western European countries. How many American lives would have been saved each year? Asked the researchers. If U.S. mortality rates had matched those of other wealthy nations, a staggering number is the answer. According to researchers, the U.S. started out of the gate in 1933 as a global health frontrunner, showing a significant advantage in mortality rates over the peer countries studied. But starting in 1970s, something went awry. Overall, Americans began to die at higher rates than their peers, a trend that grew steadily and picked up steam in the 2000s. By the year 2019, the number of annual excess deaths had reached a stunning 656,353. Bohr and his colleagues referred to these people who died as missing Americans, the friends, family members, and colleagues who would still be with them if only modern U.S. healthcare and social policy lived up to their early promise. Consider the figure of 656,353 missing Americans is the number of excess deaths just in the year 2019 alone. In a single year, Americans lost needlessly more than the population of Detroit, Las Vegas, or Baltimore. And this was before the pandemic. In 2021, the number of missing Americans swelled to 1,092,293, a whole lot more than you could put on milk cartons. More than Atlanta and Miami combined. Even worse, half of them were under age 65. Bohr and his fellow researchers found that, on average, not only were there more Americans dying relative to their peers abroad, the deaths were becoming younger. These are human beings who didn't have to live with their peer Americans. People who had children, elders, and neighbors to look after. Contributions to make, love and laughter to share. The researchers found a haunting way to help them envision the profound depth of the tragedy. Based on the age at which Americans succumbed and the number of years they could have been expected to live, had they been born in Finland, Spain, Japan, or other countries' studies, Bohr and colleagues tabulate that in a single year. 2021, America sustained 25 million years of life lost. Again, the figure of 25 million years of life lost is only for the year 2021. In 2022, as even more people die at 60 instead of 80, millions more future years of life will never be lived. The coronavirus is supposed to prey most viciously on the elderly. But in America, people still in their working years have been dropping away at higher rates during the pandemic than in peer nations, as they have been for years. Unsurprisingly, Black and Native Americans make up a disproportionate share of those vanished years and lives. Why, in a country with so much to spend and so much spent on medical care, are so many lives being cut short? How did Americans start out so well and end up so badly? Bohr notes that the American mortality advantage in the late 1930s and 1940s was impacted by the high death rates in peer countries due to the Second World War, and that the disadvantage of much of Europe and Japan likely continued for about a decade after the war because of the widespread devastation. But he also points to several other factors that probably helped Americans live longer into the 1950s, such as the relative strength of organized labor and consequent rising wages, plus the large public investments that helped boost the middle class, like the GI Bill and the promotion of high-income ownership, with the caveat that these advantages were primarily available to white Americans. Bohr observed that the later period of American mortality advantage was likely bolstered by Johnson's War on Poverty and the marked expansion of the safety net by Medicare and Medicaid, as well as the racial integration of hospitals in 1963, and environmental regulation which made water and air healthier. All of which, these programs and policies took some of the gains that occurred in 1950s and expanded them so that it wasn't just people with middle-class incomes and white people who had access to the detriments of a healthy, long life, he explains. Yet even during the period of relative mortality advantages, America's inequality and structural racism likely held back the country's longevity record from being as good as it could have been. Older populations in the U.S. have tended to have better mortality outcomes relative to peer countries than younger groups. Bohr cites the fact that Americans have to reach the age of 65 before benefits like universal healthcare kick in as negatively impacting younger people's life expectancy. This age-related trend shifted somewhat from 1980 to 2000. But the researchers found that in the 2000s, the age-related mortality picture is clear. The story of the U.S. disadvantage is primarily about people under 65 dying at higher rates than in peer countries. The year when America's overall mortality numbers diverged from other wealthy nations is 1980, according to the researchers' findings. If the name Ronald Reagan comes to mind, you're not alone. Bohr notes that a Twitter discussion of the team's work has homed in on this association. However, he emphasizes that the story is more complicated than one man's presidency and its attendant policy changes, citing multiple factors such as the rise in opioid-related deaths in 2000s, as well as increasing deaths due to obesity, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome. Gun violence has also increased America's relative death toll.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Kashmir is decorated with Indian flags as India is marking its 75th Independence Day anniversary. Government offices, schools, colleges, official vehicles, roads and streets in and around Kashmir were decorated with the Indian flag as part of a government-led nationwide campaign dubbed Tricolor in Every Home. In Srinagar's Sher-e Kashmir Stadium, Kashmir's Lieutenant Governor Manoj Sinha unfurled the Indian tricolour in the presence of government officials.
A new dawn of hopes and dreams is here. Since August 2019, the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir is scripting history and is recording unprecedented performance in every sector.
The administration in Kashmir took stringent security measures to ensure a smooth flag hoisting ceremony. Barbed wires were stretched across roads, guarded by security forces to avoid the breach of security or any militant attack. Shops and business establishments were closed and traffic remained largely suspended. But prominent politicians in Kashmir say holding such celebrations in Kashmir only hurts the sentiments of the people of Kashmir and is just rubbing salt in the wounds after what they call India's illegal move of scrapping Kashmir's special status on August 5, 2019.
Post-abrogation of Article 317, New Delhi has not been fair to the people of Kashmir. It was a death of democracy. People's wishes and aspirations were not considered. The unfurling of the tricolor in the city center by a handful of people amid tough security is not what we call normality. If it was normal, people would have participated in large numbers, and this is what the government of India needs to address.
He added, in the absence of political process, people of Kashmir seem to have lost all rights and have been silenced. The decisions are taken without taking people on board.
On August 5, 2019, New Delhi abrogated Kashmir's special status and divided the region into two parts, calling it integrating the region with the rest of India. Experts say if India wants to win over the hearts of Kashmiri people, instead of imposing decisions, India must start addressing the concerns of people. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Meet Rira, the latest crossover